was long and relatively narrow. It was at the end of something like a wing, the main house spreading to either side from an area roughly three-quarters of the way down the hall. There were windows on two sides of the study, and it was bright enough in spite of the grey, rainy day. The walls were dotted with colourful shipping charts in handsome teak frames, and among them was mounted an equally handsome set of weather instruments in a brass-bound, glass-fronted case. It contained an anemometer. Hull had the little whirling cups mounted on one of the roof peaks, I supposed. Two thermometers, one registering the outdoor temperature and the other that of the study. And a barometer, much like the one which had fooled Holmes into believing the bad weather was about to break. I noticed the glass was still rising, then looked outside. The rain was falling harder than ever. Rising glass or no rising glass? We believe we know a great lot with our instruments and things, but I was old enough then to believe we don't know half as much as we think we do, and old enough now to believe we never will. Holmes and I both turned to look at the door. The bolt was torn free, but leaning inward, as it should have been. The key was still in the study side lock, and still turned. Holmes's eyes, watering as they were everywhere at once, noting, cataloguing, storing. "You are a little better," I said. "Yes," he said, lowering the napkin and stuffing it indifferently back into his coat pocket. He may have loved them, but he apparently didn't allow them in here, not on a regular basis anyway. What do you make of it, Watson? Although my eyes were slower than his, I was also looking around. The double windows were all locked with thumb turns and small brass side bolts. None of the panes had been broken. Most of the framed charts and the box of weather instruments were between these windows. The other two walls were filled with books. There was a small coal stove, but no fireplace. The murderer hadn't come down the chimney like Father Christmas, not unless he was narrow enough to fit through a stovepipe and clad in an asbestos suit, for the stove was still very warm. The desk stood at one end of this long, narrow, well-lit room. The opposite end was a pleasantly bookish area, not quite a library, with two high-backed upholstered chairs and a coffee table between them. On this table was a random stack of volumes. The floor was covered with a Turkish rug. If the murderer had come through a trap door, I hadn't the slightest idea how he'd gotten back under that rug without disarranging it. And it was not disarranged, not in the slightest. The shadows of the coffee table legs lay across it without even a hint of a ripple. "Do you believe it, Watson?" Holmes asked, snapping me out of what was almost a hypnotic trance. Something about that coffee table. Believe what, Holmes? That all four of them simply walked out of the parlour in four different directions 4 minutes before the murder? I don't know, I said faintly. I don't believe it, not for a mo-" He broke off. Watson, are you all right? No, I said in a voice I could hardly hear myself. I collapsed into one of the library chairs. My heart was beating too fast. I couldn't seem to catch my breath. My head was pounding. My eyes seemed to have suddenly grown too large for their sockets. I could not take them from the shadows of the coffee table legs upon the rug. I am most definitely not all right. At that moment, Lestrade appeared in the study doorway.
If you've looked your fill, he broke off. What the devil's the matter with Watson?
I believe, said Holmes in a calm, measured voice, that Watson has solved the case. Have you, Watson? I nodded my head. Not the entire case, perhaps, but most of it. I knew who. I knew how. Is it this way with you, Holmes? I asked. When you see? Yes, he said. Though I usually manage to keep my feet.
Watson's solved the case? Lestrade said impatiently. Bah! Watson's offered 1,000 solutions to 100 cases before this, Holmes, as you very well know, and all of them wrong. It's his bête noire. Why, I remember just this last summer.
I know more about Watson than you ever shall, Holmes said, and this time he has hit upon it. I know the look. He began to sneeze again. The cat with the missing ear had wandered into the room through the door, which Lestrade had left open. It moved directly toward Holmes with an expression of what seemed to be affection on its ugly face.
If this is how it is for you, I said, I'll never envy you again, Holmes. My heart should burst.
One becomes inured even to insight, Holmes said, with not the slightest trace of conceit in his voice. Out with it, then, or shall we bring in the suspects, as in the last chapter of a detective novel?
No!
I cried in horror. I had seen none of them. I had no urge to. Only I think I must show you how it was done. If you and Inspector Lestrade will only step out into the hall for a moment. The cat reached Holmes and jumped into his lap, purring like the most satisfied creature on earth. Holmes exploded into a perfect fusillade of sneezes. The red patches on his face, which had begun to fade, burst out afresh. He pushed the cat away and stood up.
"Be quick, Watson, so we can leave this damned place," he said in a muffled voice,
and left the room with his shoulders in an uncharacteristic hunch, his head down, and with not a single look back. Believe me when I say that a little of my heart went with him. Lestrade stood leaning against the door, his wet coat steaming slightly, his lips parted in a detestable grin.
"Shall I take Holmes's new admirer, Watson?"
"Leave it," I said, "and close the door when you go out."
"I'd lay a fiver you're wasting our time, old man," Lestrade said,
but I saw something different in his eyes. If I'd offered to take him up on the wager, he would have found a way to squirm out of it.
"Close the door," I repeated. "I shan't be long."
He closed the door. I was alone in Hull's study, except for the cat, of course, which was now sitting in the middle of the rug, tail curled neatly about its paws, green eyes watching me. I felt in my pockets and found my own souvenir from last night's dinner. Men on their own are rather untidy people, I fear, but there was a reason for the bread other than general slovenliness. I almost always kept a crust in one pocket or the other, for it amused me to feed the pigeons that landed outside the very window where Holmes had been sitting when Lestrade drove up.
"Pussy," said I,
and put the bread beneath the coffee table, the coffee table to which Lord Hull would have presented his back when he sat down with his two wills, the wretched old one and the even more wretched new one. "Puss, puss, puss." The cat rose and walked languidly beneath the table to investigate the crust. I went to the door and opened it.
"Holmes! Lestrade! Quickly!"
They came in.
"Step over here,"
I said, and walked to the coffee table. Lestrade looked about and began to frown, seeing nothing. Holmes, of course, began to sneeze again.
"Can't we have that wretched thing out of here?"
he managed from behind the table napkin, which was now quite soggy.
"Of course," said I. "But where is the wretched thing, Holmes?"
A startled expression filled his wet eyes. Lestrade whirled, walked towards Hull's writing desk, and peered behind it. Holmes knew his reaction should not have been so violent if the cat had been on the far side of the room. He bent and looked beneath the coffee table, saw nothing but the rug and the bottom row of the two bookcases opposite, and straightened up again. If his eyes had not been spouting like fountains, he should have seen all then. He was, after all, right on top of it. But one must also give credit where credit is due, and the illusion was devilishly good. The empty space beneath his father's coffee table had been Jory Hull's masterpiece.
"I don't,"
Holmes began. And then the cat, who found my friend much more to its liking than any stale crust of bread, strolled out from beneath the table and began once more to twine ecstatically about his ankles. Lestrade had returned, and his eyes grew so wide I thought they might actually fall out. Even having understood the trick, I myself was amazed. The scarred tomcat seemed to be materializing out of thin air. head, body, white-tipped tail last. It rubbed against Holmes's leg, purring as Holmes sneezed. "That's enough," I said. "You've done your job and may leave." I picked it up, took it to the door, getting a good scratch for my pains, and tossed it unceremoniously into the hall. I shut the door behind it. Holmes was sitting down.
"By God,"
he said in a nasal, clogged voice. Lestrade was incapable of any speech at all. His eyes never left the table and the faded Turkish rug beneath its legs, an empty space that had somehow given birth to a cat.
"I should have seen," Holmes was muttering. "Yes, but you, how did you understand so quickly?"
I detected the faintest hurt and pique in that voice, and forgave it at once.
"It was those," I said, and pointed at the rug. "Of course,"
Holmes nearly groaned. He slapped his welted forehead.
"Idiot! I'm a perfect idiot!"
"Nonsense," I said tartly. "With a house full of cats, and one who has apparently picked you out for a special friend, I suspect you were seeing 10 of everything."
"What about the rug?" Lestrade asked impatiently. "It's very nice, I'll grant, and probably expensive, but..." "Not the rug," I said. "The shadows."
"Show him, Watson,"
Holmes said wearily, lowering the napkin into his lap. So I bent and picked one of them off the floor. Lestrade sat down in the other chair hard, like a man who has been unexpectedly punched.
"I kept looking at them, you see," I said, speaking in a tone which could not help being apologetic. "This seemed all wrong. It was Holmes's job to explain the whos and hows at the end of the investigation. Yet while I saw that he now understood everything, I knew he would refuse to speak in this case. And I suppose a part of me, the part that knew I would probably never have another chance to do something like this, wanted to be the one to explain. And the cat was rather a nice touch, I must say. A magician could have done no better with a rabbit and a top hat. I knew something was wrong, but it took a moment for it to sink in. This room is extremely bright, but today it's pouring down rain. Look around, and you'll see that not a single object in this room casts a shadow, except for these table legs." Lestrade uttered an oath. "It's rained for nearly a week," I said, "but both Holmes's barometer and the late Lord Hull's," I pointed to it, "said that we could expect sun today. In fact, it seemed a sure thing. So he added the shadows as a final touch."
"Who did?"
"Jury Hull,"
Holmes said in that same weary tone.
"Who else?"
I bent down and reached my hand beneath the right end of the coffee table. It disappeared into thin air, just as the cat had appeared. Lestrade uttered another startled oath. I tapped the back of the canvas, stretched tightly between the forward legs of the coffee table. The books and the rug bulged and rippled, and the illusion, nearly perfect as it had been, was instantly dispelled. Jory Hull had painted the nothing under his father's coffee table, had crouched behind the nothing as his father entered the room, locked the door, and sat at his desk with his two wills, and at last had rushed out from behind the nothing, dagger in hand. He was the only one who could execute such an extraordinary piece of realism, I said, this time running my hand down the face of the canvas. We could all hear the low rasping sound it made, like the purr of a very old cat. The only one who could execute it, and the only one who could hide behind it, Jory Hull, who was no more than 5 feet tall, bow-legged, slump-shouldered. As Holmes said, the surprise of the new will was no surprise. Even if the old man had been secretive about the possibility of cutting the relatives out of the will, which he wasn't, only simpletons could have mistaken the import of the visit from the solicitor, and more important, the assistant. It takes two witnesses to make a will a valid document, a chancery. What Holmes said about some people preparing for disaster was very true. A canvas as perfect as this was not made overnight or in a month. You may find he had it ready, should it need to be used, for as long as a year.
Or five, Holmes interpolated.
I suppose. At any rate, when Hull announced that he wanted to see his family in the parlour this morning, I imagine Jory knew the time had come. After his father had gone to bed last night, he would have come down here and mounted his canvas. I suppose he may have put down the faux shadows at the same time, but if I had been Jury, I should have tiptoed in here for another peek at the glass this morning before the previously announced parlour gathering, just to make sure it was still rising. If the door was locked, I suppose he filched the key from his father's pocket and returned it later.
"Wasn't locked," Lestrade said laconically. "As a rule, he kept the door shut to keep the cats out, but rarely locked it.
As for the shadows, they are just strips of felt, as you now see. His eye was good. They are about where they would have been at 11 this morning, if the glass had been right."
"If he expected the sun to be shining, why did he put down shadows at all?" Lestrade grumped. "Sun puts them down as a matter of course, just in case you've never noticed your own, Watson."
Here I was at a loss. I looked at Holmes, who seemed grateful to have any part in the answer.
"Don't you see? That is the greatest irony of all. If the sun had shone as the glass suggested it would, the canvas would have blocked the shadows. Painted shadow legs don't cast them, you know. He was caught by shadows on a day when there were none, because he was afraid he would be caught by none on a day when his father's barometer said they would almost certainly be everywhere else in the room. I still don't understand how Jury got in here without Hull seeing him," Lestrade said.
"That puzzles me as well," Holmes said. Dear old Holmes. I doubt that it puzzled him a bit, but that was what he said.
"Watson?"
"The parlour where Lord Hull met with his wife and sons has a door which communicates with the music room, does it not?"
"Yes," Lestrade said. "And the music room has a door which communicates with Lady Hull's morning room, which is next in line as one goes toward the back of the house. But from the morning room one can only go back into the hall, Dr. Watson. If there had been two doors into Hull's study, I should hardly have come after Holmes on the run as I did."
He said this last in tones of faint self-justification.
"Oh, Jory went back into the hall, all right," I said. "But his father didn't see him."
"Rot!"
"I'll demonstrate," I said, and went to the writing desk, where the dead man's cane still leaned. I picked it up and turned towards them. "The very instant Lord Hull left the parlour, Jory was up and on the run." Lestrade shot a startled glance at Holmes. Holmes gave the inspector a cool, ironic look in return. I did not understand those looks then, nor give them much thought at all, if the whole truth be told. I did not fully understand the wider implications of the picture I was drawing for yet a while. I was too wrapped up in my own recreation, I suppose. He nipped through the first connecting door, ran across the music room, and entered Lady Hull's morning room. He went to the hall door then and peeked out. If Lord Hull's gout had gotten so bad as to have brought on gangrene, he would have progressed no more than a quarter of the way down the hall, and that is optimistic. Now mark me, Inspector Lestrade, and I will show you the price a man pays for a lifetime of rich food and strong drink. If you harbour any doubts when I've done, I shall parade a dozen gout sufferers before you, and each one will show the same ambulatory symptoms I now intend to demonstrate. Please notice above all how fixed my attention is. And where?" With that I began to stump slowly across the room toward them, both hands clamped tightly on the ball of the cane. I would raise one foot quite high, bring it down, pause, and then draw the other leg along. Never did my eyes look up. Instead, they alternated between the cane and that forward foot.
"Yes," Holmes said quietly. "The good doctor is exactly right, Inspector Lestrade. The gout comes first, then the loss of balance, then, if the sufferer lives long enough, the characteristic stoop brought on by always looking down."
"Jory would have been very aware of how his father fixed his attention when he walked from place to place," I said. "As a result, what happened this morning was diabolically simple." When Jory reached the morning room, he peeped out the door, saw his father studying his feet and the tip of his cane, just as always, and knew he was safe. He stepped out right in front of his unseeing father and simply nipped into the study. The door, Lestrade informs us, was unlocked, and really, how great would the risk have been? They were in the hall together for no more than 3 seconds, and probably a little less. I paused. That hall floor is marble, isn't it? He must have kicked off his shoes.
He was wearing slippers, Lestrade said, in a strangely calm tone of voice, and for the second time his eyes met Holmes.
Ah, I said, I see. Jory gained the study well ahead of his father and hid behind his cunning stage flat. Then he withdrew the dagger and waited. His father reached the end of the hall. Jory heard Stanley call down to him and heard his father call back that he was fine. Then Lord Hull entered his study for the last time, closed the door, and locked it. They were both looking at me intently, and I understood some of the godlike power Holmes must have felt at moments like these, telling others what only he could know. And yet I must repeat that it is a feeling I should not have wanted to have too often. I believe the urge to repeat such a feeling would have corrupted most men, men with less iron in their souls than was possessed by my friend Sherlock Holmes. Old Keglegs would have made himself as small as possible before the locking up happened, perhaps knowing, or only suspecting, that his father would have one good look around before turning the key and shooting the bolt. He may have been gouty and going a bit soft about the edges, but that doesn't mean he was going blind.
Stanley says his eyes were top hole, Lestrade said. One of the first things I asked.
So he looked around, I said, and suddenly I could see it. And I suppose this was also the way it was with Holmes. This reconstruction, which, while based only upon facts and deduction, seemed to be half a vision. He saw nothing to alarm him, nothing but the study as it always was, empty save for himself. It's a remarkably open room. I see no closet door, and with the windows on both sides, there are no dark nooks and crannies, even on such a day as this. Satisfied that he was alone, he closed the door, turned his key, and shot the bolt. Jory would have heard him stump his way across to the desk. He would have heard the heavy thump and wheeze of the chair cushion as his father landed on it. A man in whom gout is well advanced does not sit so much as position himself over a soft spot and then drop onto it, seat first. And then Jory would at last have risked a look out. I glanced at Holmes.
"Go on, old man," he said warmly. "You're doing splendidly, absolutely first rate."
I saw he meant it. Thousands would have called him cold, and they would not have been wrong, precisely. But he also had a large heart. Holmes simply protected it better than most men do.
"Thank you."
Jory would have seen his father put his cane aside and place the papers, the two packets of papers, on the blotter. He did not kill his father immediately, although he could have done. And that's what's so gruesomely pathetic about this business, and that's why I wouldn't go into that parlour where they are for £1,000. I wouldn't go in unless you and your men dragged me.
"How do you know he didn't do it immediately?"
Lestrade asked. "The scream came several minutes after the key was turned and the bolt drawn. You said so yourself, and I assume you have enough testimony on that point not to doubt it. Yet it can only be a dozen long paces from door to desk. Even for a gouty man like Lord Hull, it would have taken half a minute, 40 seconds at the outside, to cross to the chair and sit down. Add 15 seconds for him to prop his cane where you found it and put his wills on the blotter. What happened then? What happened during that last minute or two, a short time which must have seemed, to Jory Hull at least, almost endless? I believe Lord Hull simply sat there, looking from one will to the other. Jory would have been able to tell the difference between the two easily enough. The differing colours of the parchment would have been all the clue he needed. He knew his father intended to throw one of them into the stove. I believe he waited to see which one it would be. There was, after all, a chance that the old devil was only having a cruel, practical joke at his family's expense. Perhaps he would burn the new will and put the old one back in the safe. Then he could have left the room and told his family the new will was safely put away. Do you know where it is, Lestrade? The safe? 5 of the books in that case swing out, Lestrade said briefly, pointing to a shelf in the library area. Both family and old man would have been satisfied then. The family would have known their earned inheritances were safe, and the old man would have gone to his grave believing he had perpetrated one of the cruelest practical jokes of all time. But he would have gone as God's victim or his own, and not Jory Hull's. Yet a third time, that queer look, half amused and half revolted, passed between Holmes and Lestrade. Myself, I rather think the old man was only savouring the moment, as a man may savour the prospect of an after-dinner drink in the middle of the afternoon, or a sweet after a long period of abstinence. At any rate, the minute passed, and Lord Hull began to rise, but with the darker parchment in his hand, and facing the stove rather than the safe. Whatever his hopes may have been, there was no hesitation on Jory's part when the moment came. He burst from hiding, crossed the distance between the coffee table and the desk in an instant, and plunged the knife into his father's back before he was fully up. I suspect the post-mortem will show the thrust clipped through the heart's right ventricle and into the lung. That would explain the quantity of blood expelled onto the desktop. It also explains why Lord Hull was able to scream before he died. And that's what did for Mr. Jory Hull. How so? Lestrade asked. A locked room is a bad business unless you intend to pass murder off as suicide, I said, looking at Holmes. He smiled and nodded at this maxim of his. The last thing Jory would have wanted was for things to look as they did. The locked room, the locked windows, the man with a knife in him where the man himself never could have put it. I think he had never foreseen his father dying with such a squall. His plan was to stab him, burn the new will, rifle the desk, unlock one of the windows, and escape that way. He would have entered the house by another door, resumed his seat under the stairs, and then, when the body was finally discovered, it would have looked like robbery.
Not to Hull's solicitor, Lestrade said.
He might well have kept his silence, however, Holmes mused, and then added brightly, I'll bet our artistic friend intended to add a few tracks, too. I have found that the better class of murderer almost always likes to throw in a few mysterious tracks leading away from the scene of the crime. He uttered a brief, humourless sound that was more bark than laugh, then looked back from the window nearest the desk to Lestrade and me. I think we all agree it would have seemed a suspiciously convenient murder under the circumstances, but even if the solicitor spoke up, nothing could have been proved. By screaming, Lord Hull spoiled everything, I said, as he'd been spoiling things all his life. The house was roused. Jory must have been in a total panic, frozen to the spot, the way a deer is by a bright light. It was Stephen Hull who saved the day, or Jory's alibi, at least, the one which had him sitting on the bench under the stairs when his father was murdered. Stephen rushed down the hall from the music room, smashed the door open, and must have hissed at Jory to get over to the desk with him at once, so it would look as if they had broken in to get... I broke off. Thunderstruck. At last I understood the glances which had been flashing between Holmes and Lestrade. I understood what they must have seen from the moment I showed them the trick hiding place. It could not have been done alone. The killing, yes. But the rest... Stephen said he and Jory met at the study door, I said slowly. That he, Stephen, burst it in, and they entered together, discovered the body together. He lied. He might have done it to protect his brother, but to lie so well when one doesn't know what has happened seems impossible, Holmes said, is the word for which you are searching. Watson? Then Jory and Stephen went in on it together, I said. They planned it together. And in the eyes of the law, both are guilty of their father's murder. My God! Not both of them, my dear Watson, Holmes said, in a tone of curious gentleness. All of them. I could only gape. He nodded. You have shown remarkable insight this morning, Watson. You have, in fact, burned with a deductive heat I wager you'll never generate again. My cap is off to you, dear fellow, as it is to any man who is able to transcend his normal nature, no matter how briefly. But in one way you have remained the same dear chap you've always been. While you understand how good people can be, you have no understanding of how black they may be. I looked at him silently, almost humbly. Not that there was much blackness here, if half of what we've heard of Lord Hull was true, Holmes said. He rose and began to pace irritably about the study. Who testifies that Jory was with Stephen when the door was smashed in? Jory, naturally. Stephen, naturally. But there are two other faces in this family portrait. One belongs to William, the third brother. Do you concur, Lestrade?
Yes, Lestrade said.
If this is the straight of the matter, William also had to be in on it. He said he was halfway down the stairs when he saw the two of them go in together, Jory a little ahead. How interesting, Holmes said, eyes gleaming. Stephen breaks in the door. As the younger and stronger, of course he must. And so one would expect simple forward motion would have carried him into the room first. Yet William, halfway down the stairs, saw Jory enter first. Why was that, Watson? I could only shake my head numbly. Ask yourself whose testimony, and whose testimony alone, we can trust here. The answer is the only witness who is not part of the family, Lord Hull's man, Oliver Stanley. He approached the gallery railing in time to see Stephen enter the room, and that is just as it should have been, since Stephen was alone when he broke it in. It was William, with a better angle from his place on the stairs, who said he saw Jory precede Stephen into the study. William said so, because he had seen Stanley and knew what he must say. It boils down to this, Watson. We know Jory was inside this room. Since both of his brothers testify he was outside, there was, at the very least, collusion. But as you say, the smooth way they all pulled together suggests something far more serious. Conspiracy, I said. Yes. Do you recall my asking you, Watson, if you believed all four of them simply walked wordlessly out of that parlour in four different directions after they heard the study door locked? Yes. Now I do. The four of them. He looked briefly at Lestrade, who nodded, and then back to me. We know Jory had to have been up and off and about his business the moment the old man left the parlour in order to reach the study ahead of him. Yet all four of the surviving family, including Lady Hull, say they were in the parlour when Lord Hull locked his study door. The murder of Lord Hull was very much a family affair, Watson. I was too staggered to say anything. I looked at Lestrade and saw an expression on his face I had never seen there before, nor ever did again, a kind of tired, sickened gravity. "What may they expect?" Holmes said, almost genially.
"Jury will certainly swing," Lestrade said. "Stephen will go to jail for life. William Hull may get life, but will more likely get 20 years in Broadmoor, a kind of living death."
Holmes bent and stroked the canvas stretched between the legs of the coffee table. It made that odd, hoarse, purring noise.
"Lady Hull," Lestrade went on, "may expect to spend the next 5 years of her life in Beechwood Manor, more commonly known to the inmates as Poxy Palace, although, having met the lady, I rather suspect she will find another way out. Her husband's laudanum would be my guess. All because Jory Hull missed a clean strike," Holmes remarked, and sighed. "If the old man had had the common decency to die silently, all would have been well. Jory would, as Watson says, have left by the window,
taking his canvas with him, of course, not to mention his trumpery shadows. Instead, he razed the house. All the servants were in, exclaiming over their dead master. The family was in confusion. How shabby their luck was, Lestrade. How close was the constable when Stanley summoned him?
Closer than you would believe, Lestrade said, hurrying up the drive to the door, as a matter of fact. He was passing on his regular rounds and heard a scream from the house. Their luck was shabby.
Holmes, I said, feeling much more comfortable in my old role. How did you know a constable was so nearby?
Simplicity itself, Watson. If not, the family would have shooed the servants out long enough to hide the canvas and shadows.
Also, to unlatch at least one window, I should think, Lestrade added, in a voice uncustomarily quiet.
They could have taken the canvas and the shadows, I said suddenly.
Holmes turned toward me.
Yes.
Lestrade raised his eyebrows.
It came down to a choice, I said to him. There was time enough to burn the new will or get rid of the hugger-mugger. This would have been just Stephen and Jory, of course, in the moments after Stephen burst in the door. They, or if you've got the temperature of the characters right, and I suppose you do, Stephen decided to burn the will and hope for the best. I suppose there was just enough time to chuck it into the stove.
Lestrade turned, looked at it, then looked back.
Only a man as black as Hull would have found strength enough to scream at the end, he said.
Only a man as black as Hull would have required a son to kill him, Holmes rejoined.
He and Lestrade looked at each other, and again something passed between them, some perfectly silent communication from which I myself was excluded.
Have you ever done it? Holmes asked, as if picking up on an old conversation.
Lestrade shook his head. Once came damned close, he said. There was a girl involved, not her fault, not really. I came close, yet that was only one.
And here there are four, Holmes returned, understanding him perfectly. Four people ill-used by a villain who should have died within 6 months anyway.
At last I understood what they were discussing. Holmes turned his grey eyes on me.
What say you, Lestrade? Watson has solved this one, although he did not see all the ramifications. Shall we let Watson decide?
All right, Lestrade said gruffly. Just be quick. I want to get out of this damn room.
Instead of answering, I bent down, picked up the felt shadows, rolled them into a ball, and put them in my coat pocket. I felt quite odd doing it, much as I had felt when in the grip of the fever which almost took my life in India.
"Capital fellow, Watson," Holmes cried. "You've solved your first case, become an accessory to murder, and it's not even tea time. And here's a souvenir for myself, an original Jory Hull. I doubt it's signed, but one must be grateful for whatever the gods send us on rainy days."
He used his penknife to loosen the artist's glue holding the canvas to the legs of the coffee table. He made quick work of it. Less than a minute later, he was slipping a narrow canvas tube into the inner pocket of his voluminous greatcoat.
"This is a dirty piece of work," Lestrade said,
but he crossed to one of the windows and, after a moment's hesitation, released the locks which held it and opened it half an inch or so.
"Say it's dirty work undone," Holmes said in a tone of almost hectic gaiety. "Shall we go, gentlemen?"
We crossed to the door. Lestrade opened it. One of the constables asked him if there was any progress. On another occasion, Lestrade might have shown the man the rough side of his tongue. This time he said shortly,
"Looks like attempted robbery gone to something worse. I saw it at once, of course. Holmes a moment later."
"Too bad,"
the other constable ventured.
"Yes," Lestrade said. "But at least the old man's scream sent the thief packing before he could steal anything. Carry on."
We left. The parlour door was open, but I kept my head down as we passed it. Holmes looked, of course. There was no way he could not have done. It was just the way he was made. As for me, I never saw any of the family. I never wanted to. Holmes was sneezing again, His friend was twining around his legs and meowing blissfully.
Let be out of here, he said, and bolted.
An hour later we were back at 221B Baker Street, in much the same positions we had occupied when Lestrade came driving up, Holmes in the window seat, myself on the sofa.
Well, Watson, Holmes said presently, how do you think you'll sleep tonight?
Like a top, I said.
And you?
Likewise, I'm sure, he said.
I'm glad to be away from those damn cats, I can tell you that.
How will Lestrade sleep, do you think? Holmes looked at me and smiled.
Poorly tonight. Poorly for a week, perhaps. But then he'll be all right.
Among his other talents, Lestrade has a great one for creative forgetting. That made me laugh.
Look, Watson, Holmes said. Here's a sight.
I got up and went to the window, somehow sure I would see Lestrade riding up in the wagon once more. Instead, I saw the sun breaking through the clouds, bathing London in a glorious late afternoon light.
It came out after all, Holmes said. Marvellous, Watson. Makes one happy to be alive.
He picked up his violin and began to play, the sun strong on his face. I looked at his barometer and saw it was falling. That made me laugh so hard I had to sit down. When Holmes asked, in tones of mild irritation, what the matter was, I could only shake my head. I am not, in truth, sure he would have understood anyway. It was not the way his mind worked.